This is an LACTO Forum production.
Welcome to Exception Handlers, the podcast where CTOs debug the challenges that keep us up at night. I'm Alex.
And I'm Bill.
And on today's episode, we're talking to Jack Britton, CEO of Cyber Samaritans. Jack, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So before we get into it, I just wanted to set the stage for what we're going to talk about and why. I guess about a month ago, Bill and I interviewed this guy, David Boskovich, who talked a lot about his company doing what he calls the software factory, which essentially making the entire process fully agentified from idea to end product with human input at the beginning and at the end. And everything else happens kind of automagically through the wonders of agentic AI. And so we wanted to talk to you, Jack, today about particulars around all that. And, you know, things like, what does the workflow look like? What agents are you using? What harnesses are you using? What process are you going through? And so just to get into it, maybe let's start with kind of workflow. And to frame that up, so take us, if you will, from like a blank page to running code. What do you do? What are the inputs? What are the outputs? What process do you go through?
Yeah, sure. So just studying through the different options, right? You've got ChatGPT, your frontier options. You've got Claude, you've got Copilot. There are just a few things that kind of, you know, set the stage for getting ready to code or getting ready to build out your workflow. So one of them is going to be centered around understanding best practices for prompts. You have a couple different ways you could do this. One of them is you can pull up the documentation. Each LLM has sort of their best practice standard. Or you can use RAG and have the LLM work for you, which is, you know, I believe the internet calls it meta prompting. And that's kind of where I start. I kind of write out, hey, go out and look up best practices for, you name the LLM. Then I'll write out end to end what a project would be. But then to kind of take it a step beyond that is understanding like control plane as well. So control plane is really what, from an end to end perspective, from a development perspective, sets the standard for the beginning of development to end and the verification, everything in the middle. And so for like Claude, it would be the Claude MD folder. It would be the dot agents folder. If you're going to use sub team agents, understanding the control planes, file structure, understanding how to write out those markdown files or instructions. So that's really where I focus. I spend about 80% of my time really just focusing on those two things and a project for one outcome. And in it, you know, you probably heard of like Parthi's method, where you break things into smaller chunks and you want the system to validate itself. Some people would use a mixture of agents. So you get different perspectives from different trained agents. And if you're doing anything that's going to be web-based, you know, the best way to do it, in my opinion, has always been Playwright MCP, writing out even test instructions so that it can test itself. Then provide you the artifacts that actually, yeah, you know, what we expect or what you've written down as expected is what we see. Can you now validate it yourself? No, by the way, here are the steps. And so that's sort of how I get to an end-to-end state for development.
So let me kind of dig into this a little bit. So to frame this, in my mind, and you know, push back if you see this differently, but in my mind, you kind of have two inputs to this whole thing, right? So the planning phase and before anything happens, and then the, let's call it reviewing phase at the very end, once the thing is done making code. Are you doing anything special? You mentioned a few things, but I'm curious, like, are you doing anything specific or special for, maybe you've covered kind of the planning part, the ending part. So like, for example, do you have some kind of a tool that lets you like focus on the most important things from the tons of code that got generated? Or are you like, tell me a little bit about the particulars of that aspect of this, the end
state. Yeah, it really depends. So if you just focus on development, then you're making the assessment that the LLM itself is going to care about security. And so the end is really the outcome. For me, when I think about building everything in the middle from planning, right, so everything in the middle that's actually going to drive the outcome, I want the machine to work for me. And so In my instructions, just like a developer would, there's a major feature change. I wanted to put a Git, put it in Git, add the comments, use that for review. So that'll be one of the things that I add as an instruction. And then prior to doing that, for every feature change, there are expectations of an outcome. So every small feature, there should be an outcome that it can test. And so what I wanted to do is stand up a server, use like Playwright MCP and actually perform those tests. But even before that, it's like picking, making sure that like, hey, we're going to use Next.js. I want to make sure the libraries that we use are up to date, they're backward compatible, they're modern, and they don't have security vulnerabilities. And so those are an instruction, and then I pin them. I found Claude's really good at pinning, so is Grok. I make sure that the code that we use throughout is one that meets best practices from a code framework perspective. And so that's one of the things that I do too, is I make sure that I add as an instruction, follow best practices for the code frameworks that we pinned. And so what that does is it actually helps us organize the code too. I remember kind of trying to adopt AI in the kind of earlier days, and you would write code for an outcome, or you'd ask it to write code for an outcome, and just you'd have files everywhere, and it wouldn't be exactly as expected organized in a way that's modular. So those are things that I try to apply into the instructions as well.
So you got my attention when you said framework. One of the things that I run into regularly is that, you put in the preparation work, you get the models to do what you think them want them to do. They come back with something, and now I have to stop, inspect it, and move on to the next thing. And one of the goals, particularly based on what we're seeing in the industry, is to have fewer of those kinds of breaks or iterations where I have to get in there and say, yeah, it's okay. Because after a while, it almost becomes a rote behavior, and you realize that you're trying to make too small of an evaluation on something that should be running much longer. So are there things that you're putting in that are mechanical or event driven, et cetera, like hooks or other things that you're putting in there that's allowing you to extend the process? So I don't want to say set and forget, but so that you can set and forget.
So I've tried, and I think industry has tried too. Okay. And so, I remember a few years ago, one of the discussions I had, it was with a CTO of a global, top 10 financial company. You know, he's like, you know, we're all in. And in fact, a lot of industry was all in. They're like, hey, let's spend a lot on tokens. This is when OpenAI kind of came out and, you know, brought it to the world. It's available. And then like a year later, everyone knows what Anthropic is. And everyone got on the Anthropic sort of, at least there was a big move from OpenAI to Anthropic from my observation. And what was interesting about that was, you know, a year after that, there was a round table one day and he says, hey, we've got to stop. And that's because, and they have, the module is called YOLO. You guys know what that stands for, right? And all the developers love it. But the issue is that it was very hard to control the outcomes. And then once you got to an outcome, it may or may not work. And even if it did, it wasn't organized well enough that you could do anything with it. And then, oh, by the way, you got to unwind it. And then, oh, by the way, the CTO is having a hard time forecasting what the cost of token per headcount might be. You know, and so now they're taking a little bit more precaution on how they use these tokens. And they're trying to come up with architectures that allows them to forecast costs with the use of AI. So to answer your question, Bill, kind of more directly, like I still follow a traditional CI/CD pipeline. I still follow with security checks all in between. Like I do SAS checks. I make sure that the libraries, the SBOM itself, we're not incorporating anything that's going to be like NPM packages that are, you know, that are DPRK packages as an example. All right. So we don't incorporate any of that into our pipeline. I like to do major feature checks. So, and that's usually a bigger jump than a regular pipeline. Usually, you know, you have a major feature you want to work with that's broken down into like three or four different developers and they're all working on a piece of that feature. Well, the AI is doing all of that. It just may be multiple AI agents, each one having sort of their own piece of it. And then there's usually a verification process. And then once we get to that one feature or that one phase, there's a stop. And the reason why I do that is because I want to make sure that the outcome's measurable and that the files themselves, if I were to put developers on this, they're familiar with how the code is structured in the files. They can actually trace the files. And one of the big problems is if you don't pin the code frameworks, if you don't give it the appropriate sort of instructions, it'll use different code languages, you know, within your framework. And now you've got, you know, two different types of disciplines and developers that you might have to pull in, or it'll make a change upstream to a function because the thing that it's working on needs to be fixed without checking any of the downstream dependencies. Now something's broke, you know, and it's only 10,000 lines under, you know. And so that's why I like to still break it up into small chunks, is because if I'm going to be responsible for the code, I need to know where things go and that things have been checked upstream and downstream.
So just a follow-up on that. Are you doing anything that helps raise those issues or makes it easier to review when you get to these larger checkpoints? And so instead of like, okay, here's, you know, 12,000 lines of code I need to inspect, it's here's a summary of it, here's functional summary, here's an object diagram, something that just makes
totally. Yeah. It depends on the project. Most of the review that I've given you is written in instruction. And so, so then what ends up happening is initially in the project itself, I'm just trying to make sure that, you know, the instruction sets from the control plane that we've built out for the project is actually working as expected. And then what ends up happening after that is it starts giving me summaries of, hey, based on your instructions, here's your view of the world as far as how this pipeline should be managed. After a while, I may let it kind of continue on its own, but it's like after a while, once I get to know that the system is working as expected. So even let's say that you're, you know, like one of my projects that I'm working on. So the Cyber Samaritans, one of the things that we do is we help fill gaps for value-added resellers. We provide consultants to fill gaps that maybe they don't have in their service department. All right. So there's a network of us. And so one of the things that I did was I used AI to build a solution. And what the solution does is, you know, if you're a contractor, you upload your resume, that resume goes to a webhook, and then it translates it in a way that the customer is going to understand it, because they need to see something that's going to be repeatable. And then it uses AI to actually read the resume and get first party documentation on all things technical, and it calls them. And it basically sets it up because their calendars are on the platform itself. Then it basically makes a call and does a one-on-one interview. It says, hey, listen, you know, this is a self-interview on the resume you provided, on the experiences that you have. Don't use AI. Don't get in front of a computer. That's the rules. If you don't know the answer, just say, I don't know. And then it just asks them a bunch of questions. And the questions are there to kind of measure soft skills, technical skills, and so forth, right? And so then if my clients, these big consulting firms, need services, what ends up happening is they can upload a job description. It outlines it. And then they can hear the interview, and then they can use the AI agent to make the interview as well. Most of that project was one written instruction, and most of it was written end to end. After about like three or four features in, I knew that the system was working. The control plane written was working. And so from there, I can let it go. And all the commits into Git with the comments include all the summaries for all the verifications that I've just talked about, where it's like, hey, I want you to stand up the UI. It's just you know, npm dev run Next.js, and I want you to go to that site. I want you to look at the new UI that we just built out based on these practices. You should meet UI UX best practices, and these are the outcomes for each feature set. And it actually Playwright MCP, it pops up. It writes the code out. All the test-driven development's actually written down, so I can review it, and it actually performs the tests on the site itself. It actually wrote everything locally because that was the instruction. I've got a pretty nice server here, and so everything is done in containers, so that in the future I can deliver it via Kubernetes. It does a really good job. So there's a point where I'll trust that the system I built or the control plane built works well enough that I can let it go. And you could do that, you know, in the middle of, like, let's say there's eight phases. By phase three, if I feel like, hey, we're getting good, consistent work, then I'll let it go from that point forward.
So I want to maybe transition to a related area, which is, so we talked a lot about the workflow. I think let's talk a little bit about the tooling. So the harness, so you've mentioned the control panel, and you've mentioned Cloud Code and Codex and Copilot. Tell us more about, you know, what tools specifically are you using? What are you using? You know, like, when are you using what? How do things compare? What kind of, what role do they play?
Yeah, sure. So tool set. So I was on Anthropic for a long time. So Claude Code, Claude CLI, and I really do enjoy Claude's harness. I actually use it's called OMLX because I have a M5 Max Pro chipset, 128 gigs unified memory on a Mac Pro. And there I'll use a bunch of open models. It's got 8 terabytes, so I got a bunch of open models that are just sitting. I'll use the open models when it comes to, like, I have sensitive client data and I don't want that data going out in the cloud. And so instead of, some people will buy a gateway to kind of prevent sensitive data from going out. I basically wrote out inspections. So the inspections would be using my local models. It'll actually pull out, PII, all that good stuff. And then I'll use, like, the cloud models afterwards to build out product, So let's see what else. I've got a DGX Spark in my closet as well. I have a bunch of containers in it. I use it pretty much with Karami's agent. I pretty much have, I think I have a Llama. I do. I have a Llama. I have a Llama CPP stood up and a bunch of open models there. And then I have Open Router as well. So I use Open Router out in the cloud. That one's a little bit more expensive than I like, but I use that one for that project I just described. So, it really depends on the use case, but, like, let's say that, I'm building a product comparison, I will, as long as there's no client information in it, I'll use bigger models. But I'll use probably the most affordable model for the use case, right? There's no point in using Fables 5 when you're doing a product comparison, right? But let's say that I'm building out a contract. Well, I'll actually use open source models. I use open source models for emails. It's kind of crazy that people will use frontier models that are out in the cloud for their emails. Okay. So there's a lot of power in that, at least whoever gets their hands on that data. So, does that help? Or do you want to hear more?
Well, you've mentioned so many things. I want to actually kind of take it sort of piece by piece. I guess, one thing, and this is a question I don't know if a lot of other people have, but I definitely have. You mentioned Claude Code and you mentioned Hermes. And, like, I am trying to form a mental model of when is one, because, like, I know people code with Hermes. I've never done that. And, like, I don't think it's for that, but it's also kind of for that. Can you just talk a little about just that, just to start with?
Like, yeah, no problem.
How do you think about a coding harness versus a long-running agent like Hermes?
Sure. Like, so for Hermes is my day-to-day, right? So, like, I'll use that for emails, organizing, doing things I don't like doing that's repeatable day-to-day in my business. And Hermes, you have this concept called a profile. Each profile has its own soul file. It has its own, its own control plane, so to speak. And so for each profile, it solves one big problem for me. And in Hermes, you can actually set up an MOA. So you have a mixture of agents. You can actually set that up in your configuration file as far as, like, how you want to use it. And so that's what I use Hermes for. If I'm going to code and I'm serious about coding, I'm probably going to lean toward Anthropic. It's pretty clear when you're using Anthropic, it was purpose built for that. If I need something that's going to be more marketing, Anthropic's not that. Okay. And maybe ChatGPT. ChatGPT is actually pretty good at, like, a marketing language, being more, hip. I don't know how to describe it. Maybe even Gemini, right? So, that might be a profile that I've had actually with Hermes. Anything that's not coding, I have not used Hermes for coding as a bottom line. I've heard it's good. I don't have the trust or have, maybe I haven't figured it out for Hermes.
Well, the place that kind of jumps out at me and the thing that I find kind of genuinely interesting about Hermes. So, to the degree that it's always on, long running and has an internal memory that it automatically maintains. Like, that strikes me as useful if you're working on a system over time, right? Like, so if you're coding and there's like a living memory that is actively and automatically maintained against that system, that's useful, and that you get kind of get for free from Hermes, right? Which you don't get from something like Claude. That you would have to actually do something manually for that to happen.
Yeah, you'd have to build a backend for Claude. And I'm pretty comfortable doing that. And I do that. What I'll do is Claude will build it out for me. So good example is, like, I had a project. It was a technical project, and it was with Semantic DLP 25.1. And so what I ended up doing was, you know, there's no wonder no one knows semantics, like 6,000 pages, the help documents and the API documents. And so I had Claude go in, and it basically chunked it. It used, I think, BM25 or something like that, put it into a PG vector database, semantic hybrid search database. So it's like a little bit more accurate than sort of your naive backends. Then I had to make a Docker container, use Cloudflare tunnels and a service auth token so that I can access it over the internet. I can give it to my engineer who's working on that project. And what that did for us was that accelerated the time it took to get the knowledge to actually go out and develop.
Yes, knowledge transfer is huge.
Yeah, yeah. So that's like one of my biggest uses for it.
Absolutely. I mean, people haven't really started worrying about tech debt because I think they can just do it over again really quickly. But none of that works if you don't have the knowledge transfer. And I think that that's an absolutely critical thing going forward.
Yeah. But to your point, Alex, on the memory piece, I was just at Black Hat this last week, and it's crazy where AI is taking things. It's a little bit scary. It's a little scary. Right? But I remember being a SOC analyst for kind of a startup company, and that's like the hardest job, in my opinion. Offensive is so much fun because you just get it right one time. Defense is pretty difficult. You got to get it right all the time. And one of the big problems in SOC services is that, you know, it takes a human about 6 months to really kind of get a groove and knowledge in a company. It takes about a year to really get the cycle, the SOC life cycle, Security Operations Center, for those that don't know. What's interesting about AI architecture is temporal memories, is kind of what you were just talking about with Hermes, is that this particular, and I don't want to say their name just because I didn't ask, but this particular technology, what it does, and I see Hermes doing this too for my own business, is that it understands what each individual member that's onboarded, how it uses the tools that it's integrated with, solves the problem of turnover. And so when that person leaves, it has memories for all the processes for a SOC lifecycle. And that's actually really exciting. It knows sort of based on integrations, we'll just say those integrations are, let's face it, they're API calls. And so there's probably an abstract layer for an MCP that's making calls on their behalf and pull intel into the platform. Or they're doing it deterministically, which would probably be the better way to do it. They've got a workflow in the background that's consuming millions of events and just scaling what humans would do, but also learning how a human does it and also challenging a human, you know, and I think that's the value of a harness. And that's exactly what Hermes is being able to understand each individual that's logged onto the platform and carrying out that temporal memory. And so a company is impacted when their best person leaves, okay, or any person in general. By having this technology in your environment that's developed in a way that's purpose-built, that has temporal memory on the front end, it's going to learn what each one of us does in a company. And so when that person leaves, the impact's much less.
That is a very fascinating thing. I mean, I think we could do a podcast just exploring that alone, but I'm going to let that go for the sake of time. And I do want to go to another thing that you mentioned. You clearly have some very juicy hardware available to you. You've mentioned
it. Here comes the hardware envy.
DGX Spark, you mentioned a Mac Studio. I'm curious about two things. One, how do they compare? Right. So obviously one is purpose built by NVIDIA using Blackwell and the unified memory and basically out of the box is designed to run AI and just be there for you. The other one is from Apple, but it's got similarly massive amounts of memory, very powerful. How do you compare them, like one versus the other, in terms of what you can do with them?
Well, Mac feels more efficient. The NVIDIA, my closet's like 200 degrees hot. But I guess, you know, this is what I noticed when you're on a Mac, you have to use the extension MLX. I don't know what it stands for. And this, you know, this is a little bit outside of my own technical knowledge, but I'm going to give you what I know. Okay. And so, and what I've observed. And so, you know, whether you use LM Studio, which, you know, basically is a front end for like Llama, and you start to download LLMs, you're going to want to download LLMs that are MLX, because that's what the chipset's designed for. It's like, it's actually efficient for it. Unfortunately, GGRUF, there's more availability of what LLMs are out there can be used. And when you run that on a Mac, it's actually pretty hard on the Mac. I noticed that, like, the resource usage, you can run it, it's just not going to be efficient. And the way that I've read the Mac chipset works, it's an emulation, and so it's not bare bones on the metal, bare metal like the Spark is, right? So it's a little bit slower. You can barely tell though. I would say that for a laptop that I carry from place to place, so that I can make sure that, like, if I have sensitive data, that sensitive data never leaves. It's in my hands at all times. You know, it does its job. Like, I think it's really good. The NVIDIA Spark, if you're going to do any sort of training, is way better in my opinion. It's, you know, it's also unified memory, so you can just tell it's a little bit faster. And it's actually, you have more options and more availability as it applies, like, the LLMs that you can use. I want to say in the early days though, it really needed the firmware upgrades and it needed more software, and the closet's a little bit, cause that's where it is in my closet over here. Yeah. It's a little less hot than it used to be, but that's cause the latest upgrades.
So the other thing about this that I'm really curious about is, like, realistically, how good a model can you run locally? I mean, whether you want to name specific ones you're running or just generally, like, what can you expect from, I have like a coding payload, you know, a task I needed to do. Can I do it locally and get results?
Yeah, I could tell you the models I've run. And I think there's something more to this too. It's like, I want to run Docker containers. The problem is that hits resources, right? So I don't trust remote MCPs oftentimes. I want to test them until I trust them. And so even though you might have this machine with all of this RAM, it's all shared, you know, it's shared GPU, CPU, and NPU, right? When you stand up Docker containers, it starts to eat away at resources. And so then you have to still be selective, and you should be, because you have limited hardware. So on my Mac, I try not to run any Docker containers. I try not to run anything other than one browser. I use Brave, you know, because it's not Chrome. That's just eating up resources all the time. And I despise getting on Teams because that eats up resources all the time. Okay. I usually do Docker remote on a server, but it's a server that I own through Cloudflare Tunnels. And then on my Spark, what can I tell you? I ran probably the biggest model. It was the ChatGPT OSS 120 billion parameter. I tried running bigger models than that. The issue was, you know, I've had it to the point to where it's like shut down the server. So it's happened to me a few times on that machine. And I think that's also because I was using Llama, and Llama is not very good. It's not very efficient at managing resources. And I haven't found something that's efficient managing resources for Spark. And maybe there's something there and I just don't know about it. On the Mac, OMLX is actually really, I mean, it's built for the Mac. It's really good at understanding what resources you have and how to allocate, you know, do the more advanced stuff. Like, the more advanced users know how to, like, hey, I'm going to take this model and I'm going to quantize it. You know, I'm going to do it at 8-bit so that, like, you know, I don't recognize quality loss. But I can still deal with this. I could still actually have this large model. It kind of does that for you, is my understanding in the background. I've seen it do it. I want to say recently, I'd have to go back, but I still think that 120 billion parameter is probably the biggest one I've done on the machines.
As far as, like, the results you're getting, have you actually, like, run proper coding tasks locally?
Okay, I have.
How'd that go?
Yeah, that's a great question. man, I don't like it. Okay. So Qwen 3.6, is it 3.6? Yeah, it's Qwen 3.6. I want to say it's like, acts like 3 billion. It's an A3B. That's probably like a 30 billion parameter model. So, you know, I think that was the one I used for coding. It was probably the best at the time. What did I use for that? I didn't use my Spark. I used the Mac. I had VS Code up and had it set up. And pretty much, if you're writing scripts, it's good enough. Like if you're writing small scripts, it's good enough. If you're doing long projects, I haven't quite figured out how to set up memory that's going to be good enough. And a lot of local models, they just have a hard time with tool calls. So like both the GPT open source models had a hard time with tool calls. The 20 billion parameter GPT open source model would switch between English and Chinese, which was sort of funny. And then in actually writing code, it would switch between languages. Like it would go TypeScript to Python. And I think it had a hard time with tool calls as well. I think Qwen was probably Qwen and Minimax, Minimax 2.7, they had an 8-bit like community version that I used, were probably the best local models for code. I think for you to be effective, you're going to have to be really good at instructing like loop engineering with the resources that you have. And then even better, with, you know, having the content go to a backend database that it can call from when it runs out of context.
Well, it seems like a very popular way to do it these days is to do the hybrid thing where you've got like, you know, you're using something like Pi or even maybe Cloud, something that lets you kind of easily manage sub-agents, but with different models for each. And then like an Opus to plan and then start subbing it out to your local model, because then the context is very contained. You know, you've gotten essentially the big smart thing to think through the details, write it down and say, you are just implementing these 10 classes.
Yes.
And off you go. And then you come back, something else happens, right?
So that's actually like what a lot of people use Hermes for. You have to be really good at instructing. Like you have to write, you know, I haven't done that with Hermes. OpenRouter, I've done that where, you know, I have an OpenRouter gateway. I'm just making API calls and I write out the instructions. And so like the planning is going to be done via Opus 4.6 at the time was 4.6. I think we're at 4.8 now, or maybe we're at 5. I don't know where we're at anymore, but, it would write out the technical planning. And I would actually provide in the instructions during the planning, hey, these are the agents I'm going to use, based on its performances that are, you know, public, write out who's going to do what. And, you know, even that's a hit or miss, man, for local LLMs, because your frontier models have such, you know, such wide context tokens that the output that it provides would just, you know, when it gets passed on to a local model, just crushes it. You know, so that's been my experience. I've tried going down that path myself. You'd be building out workflows in that case where it's like, okay, once this model is done, you're going to trigger this next model. You're going to make sure it's within a certain size limit. And you might even use an AI agent to read the output of a large model to then, you know, make it smaller just to fit the smaller models. I haven't done that. I haven't been successful with a mixture of agents using frontier models. I have been successful, and this is, again, this is why I really like Anthropic, using sub-team agents, which I don't know if they still have in beta. It was in beta at the time. Are you familiar with sub-team agents? They're different from agents.
Like they have like swarms or teams, or I forget the.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So just like you would, let's say you have a project manager, and then you have developers, and then you have UI UX guys. You have people that have different responsibilities, but they all have to kind of provide their output, right? So sub-team agent, there's a very specific way that you would write it out into your control plane. And basically, you have one orchestrator, and that orchestrator then orchestrates all the other agents that are all very aware of one another. I can tell you, I haven't had an experience with this. I was actually going to spend time with it tonight. I don't know if you all heard of Grokbot, but no, you haven't heard of Grokbot?
No, Bill?
Yeah, oh yeah.
I have.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but you got it. I've heard about it. I'm not going to see it because I'm not a super mega XAI subscriber. So
I'm like,
it's beta for only the elite.
I might have missed it.
So, I'm sub elite, so let me know how it goes.
No, you know what? I think you said it, Bill. Like, I think Grok's winning when it comes to the price wars. I think they lead, man, in the future, like probably next 2 years. You know, that's just my opinion. So
I mean, it's interesting. It's actually the price thing. I mean, you know, obviously the big reason why people are so pushing towards local is like. Yeah, you swarms and teams and stuff. We had a guy, I told Bill this story. We had a guy who did that with Claude and burned through like $3,000 in a weekend. I was like, okay, well, no more of that. Because you're just burning money. And, you know, that being able to delegate, whether it's Grok, like Gemini Flash is a very cheap model with a huge context and does pretty good. Kimi, even the NVIDIA one. Yeah, Kimi is comparatively very cheap, does some crazy stuff, especially the last one. Even NVIDIA's one, what, Nematron?
Oh, that's free on a OpenRouter.
Got like a surprisingly good performance.
It's actually pretty good.
But yeah, like this is the thing. Cost was no problem. Yeah, sure. Swarm it up. Just go nuts with Fable and everything. But that's not tenable. So it's interesting you say that you've tried but haven't quite pulled it off. I feel like that's the big unlock. If you could somehow figure out the right harness and the right combination of agents and local and cloud to cost manage, that would be amazing.
I think people were trying to figure that out. Didn't they? For Kimi 3, there was like a competition. I guess it's like, I don't know if it's competition, but it was open source. There are like 3 PhDs, obviously really smart guys. And what they did was they're letting you with 8 gigs, okay, of RAM. RAM is like the most important thing in this. I've heard, right? Like if you've got RAM, if you've got VRAM, you're set. The more of it you have, the more that you can do, and the faster you can do it, right? And what they've done is they said, okay, there has to be a way to use the entire embodiment of, 1 trillion parameter model like Kimi 3. And they were able to spread it across the resources with 8 gigs of RAM and your CPU as long as you had the storage. It was slow, but you know what that tells you is they're trying to figure it out. They're trying to figure out how to bring it down.
It seems like a mixture of expert models have an advantage because only a subset actually has to get like active at any one point. And yep. The compromise, yes, is token speed is terrible. But the thing is, if you have a long-running agent that's doing stuff, and you're not actively chatting with it, who cares that it's 5 tokens per second versus 100?
Exactly. I'm not having a coffee. I'll be back.
Yeah. I'll go do something else. I'll go talk to Claude.
there's another aspect to that too. I believe we're starting to get to the point where the larger the model doesn't mean the better the model. It has wider context, but it also means you need more precision to get what you want because at the end of the day, you're filtering to get to your answer. And secondly, there's a good chance that it's going to find things that you had never contemplated that are so far outside of the realm of what you're working on that they may not be relevant. And that's why I've been a huge fan of a mixture of models, not more mixture of agents these days. But I think based upon just the stuff Jack had mentioned and kind of what we're seeing coming out of the various frontiers, it's harness engineering is the future, at least for the near term, right?
Yeah.
And you're seeing that already. The value you're getting out of, in my mind, Anthropic is not, oh boy, this model is so amazing. No, it's they put an amazing harness around the thing. It breaks down your request into whatever dynamic number of subtasks it needs to be. And then it monitors them and, to Jack's point, adjusts the size of the context as needed dynamically, et cetera, all behind the curtains. And then it comes back to you with an interesting answer. And yes, does it take time? It does take time, but it solves this problem in a very efficient way. And I think that's going to get more efficient when we start doing things like applying a gigantic problem to a whole bunch of different levels of machines and models that are at different price points. And the system knows like, for this, I want to do something cheaper because it's very simple.
I mean, you could see that's where the battlefield is because like Cursor just released or announced like a new router that is specifically designed to essentially find the cheapest thing for the cheapest thing.
And right. Like which one of these are going to be the best?
Yeah. Pi is doing a lot of stuff in that. I mean, they're open code. Like they're all trying to figure this out. So, you know, if everyone's kind of dialed into the same problem, there's clearly a there.
Yeah, totally. Back to Grokbot though. I think you guys have to check it out. Like I'm in between meetings today. I've been doing nothing but research on this thing. Playwright MCP has been one of the best tools for like any of the code work, any of the, any project where at the end of it, I want an application, I want a website, you know? So what they've done is each bot, Alex, are you familiar with NADEN by chance? Building out like agentic workflows in NADEN?
Yeah.
Okay. You know how like an NADEN you'd have the model, it'd be like the agentic model, and then underneath it you can build out calls. You'd have tools and descriptors, and they have system user prompts, and it would make the calls, right? Well, they all incorporate that in some way, but in Grok, what they did is they designed the harness in that way. So every bot has a tool and a description specific to one thing, and each bot's actually aware of one another based on that tool and description. And so if you treat each bot to solve one problem, and let's say in that problem, it needs to get some resource from somewhere else, it'll ask that other bot, which has its own context window, to pick up that task, and then it'll submit back to it any of the lightweight exchange, any of that data. And what's really cool is, this is the first time I'm seeing it, maybe you guys know better, is each bot has its own browser. And so you can go in, you can log in, and your session stays in the browser that is remote in the cloud. I don't know if I like that yet, but you know, I like that their security is all out in the public. So you can kind of see they've already tested everything. You know, they take security really, really seriously, and they're very transparent about it. And then the other thing is each bot has its own terminal. So just like Hermes, or even if you're using Claude uses like Desktop Commander, which is an MCP you can use to control your desktop, but it's actually making execution on your desktop's really not safe. And so what Hermes does is allows you to use on the back end, you can use like a Docker container, and that's where all of your execution takes place. Well, on Grokbot, what it does, it says, here's your terminal for this particular bot. And everything that bot requires to live and do the one thing that it's purpose built for is in that space. And every bot has its own. It's pretty cool, man. I'll totally check it out. I'm thinking like web scraping. Actually, I'm thinking hacking. Like there's all kinds of stuff we're going to see this thing could do. So.
Well, thanks for the tip. I'll definitely look into it.
Well, if you're throwing out $3,000 to play around with a, you know, super team, you can afford it easily.
I definitely cannot, and I definitely will not be spending that kind of money on anything, Grok or otherwise. Well, I mean, this has been an excellent conversation. I really appreciate all the knowledge and all the information you gave us, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. Thanks, Bill.
Well, if you found this topic or topics like this one interesting or relevant to you, LA CTO Forum has lots of opportunities to engage with other CTOs about topics just like this one. If you're interested in learning more, find us on LinkedIn or on the web at lactoforum.org. Until next time, may your deployments be smooth and your tech debt manageable.
And remember, if you can't handle the exception, at least log it properly. We'll catch you next time.